Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1059, The Christian West, Part 2, Contextual Foundation of the Jim DiGenio Interviews. This is being recorded on March 5th of the year 2019. This is obviously a continuation of, or sequel to, if you will, For the Record 1057. It is also the predecessor of what will be For the Record 1060. That will be the Christian West Part 3. In the long 25-hour series of interviews with Jim DiGenio, a number of things impressed themselves on me. Obviously, I have a very high regard for that book, and I felt that a long, deep dive and a pedantic trip through that book would show us a very, or give us, a good cross-section on how American power works. In particular, a couple of items about some of Clay Shaw's connections cued much of what I'm going to be talking about in this program, and the context of the Jim DiGenio interviews. The title, The Christian West, was a plan on the part both of some of the Nazi allied industrialists and financiers and political figures and espionage officers in the UK and the US and elsewhere to ally with like-minded counterparts in Nazi Germany in what would be an anti-Soviet or anti-Bolshevik alliance, basically a Hitlerless Reich would then ally itself with the West to go after the Soviet Union. This was a dream of Heinrich Himmler, the SS chief. Himmler saw this as an above-ground, formal diplomatic and military possibility. That, in fact, did not take place, but I believe that underground, through the auspices of the Reinhard-Galen spy outfit, and Galen basically incorporated the RSHA, the SS security apparatus, and his Eastern Front spy outfit. Ultimately, Galen became the Third Reich's most important intelligence officer. It basically, as was noted by William Corson, a former Marine Corps colonel, who was the chief advisor to the Church Committee in the 70s, the Galen organization became, as he stated in his book, The Armies of Ignorance. Colonel Corson labeled the Galen organization, quote, a front for Odessa Nazis, unquote. Galen's connivance with the West was approved not only by Admiral von Dönitz, who succeeded Adolf Hitler as the German head of state, but also by General Franz Halder, who had been Galen's chief of staff. Basically, the Third Reich's chain of command was intact and approving of what Galen did. We also took a look at the fact that not only did Heinrich Müller, the brilliant General Müller who headed up the Gestapo, not die in World War II, he was taken, quote, prisoner, unquote, by American forces and ultimately freed. The file on him was largely redacted because it would, quote, shed light on U.S. intelligence gathering methods or compromise U.S. intelligence gathering methods. I suspect that is because as the chief of security for the remarkable and deadly Bormann Flight Capital organization, the underground Nazi manifestation of the German, British and American cartel system that underlay Third Reich industry, the Bormann organization had as its security director Heinrich Müller, and as Paul Manning revealed in his book, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, available for download for free from the SpitfireList.com website, Müller and his organization collaborated with the CIA. I also have noted in the past, and although we did not talk about it at great length, basically the denazification of Germany in terms of its basic institutions, its businesses, its national security establishment, meaning its intelligence service, which basically was the ORG, the Gehlen organization, its police and judicial apparatus, and for much of its history, its political apparatus as well, simply were culled from the Third Reich. There is detailed discussion of that in many programs, including AFA 37, and the book The New Germany and the Old Nazis by T.H. Pettens is available for download for free on the SpitfireList.com website as well. In fact, as was disclosed in the aftermath of the Werner-Naumann II attempt of 1953, the strings in the, quote, new, unquote, Germany were being pulled largely by what was described as a Führings ring, a network of spider-like filaments that stretched throughout the, quote, new, unquote, Germany and acted as a vehicle for political control by the Third Reich government in exile of Bormann, Mueller et al. There was a Nazi headquarters underground Nazi headquarters in Madrid, Spain, under the friendly auspices of Francisco Franco. I'm going to overlap some of the material that I spoke about last week, that we concluded the program with last week, with what I'm going to be presenting this week. Recall that we began this discussion with an excerpt from Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty's book, JFK, the CIA, Vietnam, and the Plot to Assassinate John F. Kennedy. And Colonel Prouty was relating his experience in August of 1944 when he flew a bunch of American POWs out of the Balkans, specifically out of Romania, and mixed in with this flight of this contingent of American POWs whom he helped to fly out of that area and to Egypt were not only Nazi intelligence operatives, but their files as well to be used against the former Soviet Union. This again was August of 1944. That is well before the Gehlen organization was incorporated into what became the fledgling CIA, indicating that the use of Nazis had been approved and incorporated into Western strategy well before the end of the war. That is one of the reasons why I believe the Christian West concept was in fact realized, but simply underground. Turning now once again to Destiny Betrayed by Jim DiGenio, with whom I did 25 one-hour interviews, published in soft cover by Skyhorse Publishing, and the most recent copyright date for edition 2 is 2012. There were a couple of passages from Destiny Betrayed that caught my eye, and that had to do with Clay Shaw's connections, some of the people and interests with whom he was associated. Before I get to that, actually, though, I think there is an old expression, what was old is new again. And as familiar as I am in certain ways with the fundamentals of the JFK assassination, and also as we will get to in our next program, as familiar as I am with the role of the Bush family, the Thiessens, of the Brown Brothers Harriman firm and the Union Banking Corporation in the channeling of American capital to Nazi Germany, I was really struck by not only Clay Shaw's connections, but also by the sheer power that was brought to bear in the JFK assassination. President Kennedy was obviously a president of the U.S., and yet they put him down, his killers and the forces with whom they were allied, put him down like he was a pimp on a downtown Saturday night. Said, what? Who do you think you are? President of the United States? Get out of here, you little punk. Bang. They'll take care of you. Every institution in this country was bent in unison to cover up that killing. The media, the judicial process, the intelligence services, all were bent in unison for what became a coup d'etat. And the sheer power of this engine really impressed itself on me anew. And I think as we take a look at some of the forces with which Clay Shaw was involved, I think that serves not only as an entree into some of the concepts underlying the Christian West, but also some of the concepts underlying globalization and fascism itself. We'll get to that probably more in our next program. But I think to truly understand not only our world today, but also the foundation of what we were talking about with Jim DiGiamio, I think some of this discussion is in order. Turning now to Destiny Betrayed, talking about Clay Shaw's affiliation with Permandex. What Permandex is will become quite apparent. We should also know that Clay Shaw worked for the CIA in helping to generate intelligence about the American corporate connections and commercial relationships with Latin America. That not only is a major focal point of American commerce in general, but in New Orleans in particular. It also was a major focal point of both commercial and political activity by the Borman Network and its allied corporate interests as well. Clay Shaw was deeply involved with a company called Permandex, and it turns out that Permandex was financed by the J. Henry Schroeder Company, a corporation, the Schroeder Bank, and J. Henry Schroeder in particular, Kurt von Schroeder, I should say, in particular, was one of the foundational elements of the U.S. commercial and financial connections to Nazi Germany. We talked about that at great length in many programs. We will review some of that here. We spoke about it in, for the record, 511, which in turn accesses the very first archive show, which was Uncle Sam and the Swastika, from May 23rd of 1980. The Schroeder Bank contained the Sonderkonto S, which was a special account that was financed by or contributed to by what was known as the Himmler Kreis or the Himmler Circle of Friends. This financed the day-to-day activities of the Nazi SS, and ultimately those who contributed to it got the pick of the Nazi slave labor pool in exchange for their favors. Kurt von Schroeder also had very close connections to the Thyssen milieu. We will come back to him. Also note that Alan Dulles of Sullivan and Cromwell, later CIA director, prominent member of the Warren Commission, so much so that many observers have really said that the Warren Commission should have been more appropriately titled the Dulles Commission. Hjalmar Horace Greeley Schacht, who was Hitler's first finance minister and one of the financial wizards not only behind the economic and military rise of the Third Reich, but also with some of the transatlantic capital machinations such as the Dawes and Young plans that helped to set the stage for the recapitalization of Germany and the rise of Hitler, directly linked to the cartel arrangements that had been set up after World War I. Hjalmar Horace Greeley Schacht was apparently a friend of Clay Shaw, and that is one hell of a friend. Also, we're going to talk about Freeport Sulfur. That was a prominent company that, among other places, did business in Cuba. And David Ferry and Clay Shaw, among others, collaborated in the post-Castro takeover of Cuba in attempts to get Cuban nickel ore shipped through Canada down to the U.S., where it would be processed by Freeport Sulfur and its subsidiaries in the New Orleans and other areas of Louisiana. As it turns out, not only nickel production, but through the Canadian nickel interests, IG Farben, when it was hammered together, when it was cobbled together, midwife, if you will, by John Foster Dulles, Alan Dulles' brother, another key partner in the Sullivan and Cromwell law firm, and later the Secretary of State under Dwight D. Eisenhower, when Alan Dulles was head of the CIA, the New Jersey nickel interests and their Canadian cartel partners gave IG Farben a profound place in the nickel cartel. And nickel is central not only to the manufacture of stainless steel, but also armor plate, and therefore was of primary interest to the Third Reich and its military industry. So not only the Clay Shaw connection to Permandex and through that to the Schroeder interests and also Hjalmar Schacht, but also the Clay Shaw links to Freeport Sulfur and in turn the cartel connections between Canadian nickel interests with whom Clay Shaw was apparently attempting to network along with David Ferry and the nickel cartel as cobbled together by John Foster Dulles as he was assembling IG Farben are major focal points of our discussion here.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
From Destiny Betrayed, the next step in the CIA ladder after his high-level overseas informant work was his, Clay Shaw's, work with a strange company called Permandex. When the announcement for Permandex was first made in Switzerland in late 1956, its principal backing was to come from a local banker named Hans Seligman. But as more investigation by the local papers was done, it became clear that the real backer was J. Henry Schroeder Corporation. This information was quite revealing. Schroeder's had been closely associated with Alan Dulles and the CIA for years. Alan Dulles' connections to the Schroeder banking family went back to the 30s when his law firm, Sullivan and Cromwell, first began representing them through him. Later, Dulles was the bank's general counsel. In fact, when Dulles became CIA director, Schroeder's was a repository for a $50 million contingency fund that Dulles personally controlled. Schroeder's was a welcome conduit because the bank benefited from previous CIA overthrows in both Guatemala and Iran. Another reason that there began to be a furor over Permandex in Switzerland was the fact that the bank's founder, Baron Kirch von Schroeder, was associated with the Third Reich, especially Heinrich Himmler. The project now became stalled in Switzerland. It now moved to Rome. In a September 1969 interview Shaw did for Penthouse magazine, he told James Phelan that he only grew interested in the project when it moved to Italy, which was in October of 1958. Yet a State Department cable dated April 9th of that year says that Shaw showed great interest in Permandex from the outset. One can see why. The board of directors was made up of bankers who had been tied up with fascist governments, people who worked the Jewish refugee racket during World War II, a former member of Mussolini's cabinet, and the son-in-law of Hjalmar Schacht, the economic wizard behind the Third Reich, who was a friend of Shaw's. One more time. Of Permandex, the board of directors was made up of bankers who had been tied up with fascist governments, people who worked the Jewish refugee racket during World War II, a former member of Mussolini's cabinet, and the son-in-law of Hjalmar Schacht, the economic wizard behind the Third Reich, who was a friend of Shaw's. These people would all appeal to the conservative, Shaw. There were at least four international newspapers that exposed the bizarre activities of Permandex when it was in Rome. One problem was the mysterious source of funding. No one knew where it was coming from. Another was that its activities reportedly included assassination attempts on French Premier Charles de Gaulle, which would make sense since the founding member of Permandex, Ferenc Nagy, N-A-G-Y, was a close friend of Jacques Soustel, S-O-U-S-T-E-L-L-E. Soustel was a leader of the OAS, a group of former French officers who broke with de Gaulle over his Algerian policy. They later made several attempts on de Gaulle's life, which the CIA was privy to. Again, this mysterious source of funding plus the right-wing neo-fascist directors created another wave of controversy. One newspaper wrote that the organization may have been, quote, a creature of the CIA, set up as a cover for the transfer of CIA funds in Italy for illegal political espionage activities, unquote. The Schroeder connection would certainly suggest that. Now, of Clay Shaw, his association with Freeport Sulphur, which, by the way, later held forth in a big way in Indonesia, which had a large Nazi party, courtesy of the very large Dutch Nazi party, may also have had, in addition to its own considerable natural resources, some Japanese golden lily loot stashes. Of the association between Clay Shaw, Freeport Sulphur, and Canadian nickel interests. Very important. Clay Shaw, Freeport Sulphur, and Canadian nickel interests. We read the following, again, from Destiny Betrayed by Jim DiGiamio. In Chapter 1, the author introduced Freeport Sulphur and its subsidiaries Moab Bay Mining and Nicaro Nickel. These companies all had large investments in Cuba prior to Castro's revolution. And this ended up being one of the ways that Garrison connected Clay Shaw and David Ferry. This came about for two reasons. First, with Castro taking over their operations in Cuba, Freeport was attempting to investigate bringing in nickel ore from Cuba through Canada, which still had trade relations with Cuba. One more time. First, with Castro taking over their operations in Cuba, Freeport was attempting to investigate bringing in nickel ore from Cuba through Canada, which still had trade relations with Cuba. The ore would then be refined in Louisiana, either at a plant already in New Orleans or at another plant in Braithwaite. Shaw, an impresario of international trade, was on this exploratory team for Freeport. He and two other men had been flown to Canada by David Ferry as part of this effort. More evidence of this connection through Freeport was found during their investigation of Guy Bannister. Bannister apparently knew about another flight taken by Shaw with an official of Freeport, likely Charles White, W-I-G-H-T, to Cuba. Again, the pilot was David Ferry. Another reason this Freeport connection was important to Garrison is that he found a witness named James Plaine, P-L-A-I-M-E, in Houston, who said that Mr. White of Freeport Sulphur had contacted him in regards to an assassination plot against Castro. Considering the amount of money Freeport was about to lose in Cuba, plus the number of Eastern establishment luminaries associated with the company, such as Jock Whitney, Jean Mose, M-A-U-Z-E, and Godfrey Rockefeller, it is not surprising that such a thing was contemplated within their ranks. So again, note, Clay Shaw and his links with not only the Schroeder Dulles Nazi SS connection, but also Clay Shaw and his work on behalf of Freeport Sulphur to take nickel from Cuba and have it come down through Canada to be processed by Freeport Sulphur. We're about to talk about the role of the nickel cartel in the IG Farben situation. However, I think in terms, once again, of understanding American power structure, a brief primer, and it will be brief, about just where Sullivan and Cromwell fit into the U.S. commercial power structure. Both Allen and John Foster Dulles, both of them Nazi collaborators, and John Foster was Secretary of State under Dwight D. Eisenhower, while Allen Dulles was head of the CIA. Both of them were partners in Sullivan and Cromwell. And Sullivan and Cromwell was at the very foundation of Wall Street big business. A book called The Brothers, John Foster Dulles, Allen Dulles and Their Secret World War by Stephen Kinzer goes into some of the history of Sullivan and Cromwell. They write, in 1882, Sullivan and Cromwell, created Edison General Electric, that later became General Electric. 7 years later, with the financier J.P. Morgan as its client, it will 21 steelmakers into the National Tube Company, and then in 1891, merge National Tube with 7 other companies to create U.S. Steel, capitalized at more than $1 billion, an astounding sum at that time. The railroad magnate E.H. Harriman, whom President Theodore Roosevelt had denounced as a, quote, malefactor of great wealth, unquote, and, quote, an enemy of the Republic, unquote, hired the firm to wage 2 of his legendary proxy wars, one to take over the Illinois Central Railroad and another to fend off angry shareholders at Wells Fargo Bank. It won the first with tactics that the New York newspaper called, quote, one of those ruthless exercises of the power of sheer millions, unquote, and the second, with complex maneuvers that, according to a book about the firm, amounted to, quote, deceit, bribery, and trickery that was all legal, unquote. Soon afterward, working on behalf of French investors who were facing ruin after their effort to build a canal across Panama collapsed, Sullivan and Cromwell achieved a unique triumph in global politics. Through a masterful lobbying campaign, its endlessly resourceful managing partner William Nelson Cromwell persuaded the United States Congress to reverse its decision to build a canal across Nicaragua and to pay his French clients $40 million for their land in Panama instead. By the way, at this point in time, around the turn of the last century, circa 1900, $40 million was a lot of money. Continuing. Then he, William Nelson Cromwell, helped engineer a revolution that pulled the province of Panama away from Colombia and established it as an independent country led by a clique willing to show its gratitude by allowing construction of a canal on terms favorable to the United States. One newspaper called him, quote, the man whose masterful mind, whetted on the grindstone of corporate cunning, conceived and carried out the rape of the isthmus, unquote. So again, pointing out the central, pivotal role of Sullivan and Cromwell, or perhaps their place in the cosmos of American finance and industry. One could not basically exaggerate it. Now, John Foster Dulles was the guy who cobbled together I.G. Farben, the consummately powerful German chemical firm, which in turn had profound cartel connections around the world and became not only the arguably the most important linchpin of Nazi industry, but again, arguably the most important linchpin of the remarkable and deadly post-war Bormann capital organization. And again, in this, note the role of nickel interests, and in particular, Canadian nickel interests and their links with the International Nickel Company in New Jersey, and the role of this in the cobbling together, the midwiving of I.G. Farben by John Foster Dulles. Reading from the brothers John Foster Dulles, Alan Dulles, and Their Secret World War by Stephen Kinzer. Foster had helped design the Dawes Plan of 1924, which restructured Germany's reparation payments in ways that opened up huge new markets for American banks. And later that year, he arranged for five of them to lend $100 million to German borrowers. In the 7 years that followed, he and his partners brokered another $900 million in loans to Germany, the equivalent of more than $15 billion in early 21st century dollars. This made him the preeminent salesman of German bonds in the U.S. and probably the world. He sharply rejected critics who argued that American banks should invest more in the United States and protested when the State Department sought to restrict loans to Germany that were unrelated to reparation payments or that supported cartels or monopolies. Foster made much money building and advising cartels, which are based on agreements among competing firms to control supplies, fix prices, and close their supply and distribution networks to outsiders. Reformers in many countries railed against these cartels, but Foster defended them as guarantors of stability that ensured profits while protecting economies from unpredictable swings. Two that he shaped became global forces. Among Foster's premier clients was the New Jersey-based International Nickel Company, for which he was not only counsel, but also a director and a member of the executive board. In the early 1930s, he steered it, along with its Canadian affiliate, into a cartel with France's two major nickel producers. In 1934, he brought the biggest German nickel producer, I.G. Farben, into the cartel. This gave Nazi Germany access to the cartel's resources. Quote, without Dulles, according to a study of Sullivan and Cromwell, again quoting, Germany would have lacked any negotiating strength with International Nickel, which controlled the world's supply of nickel, a crucial ingredient in stainless steel and armor plate, unquote. I'm going to read this last paragraph again because it is, I think, very important to understand in connection not only with Foster Dulles, but what really is so significant, in my opinion, about the Canadian Freeport Sulphur Clay Shaw nickel machinations. Among Foster's premier clients was the New Jersey-based International Nickel Company, for which he was not only counsel, but also a director and member of the executive board. In the early 1930s, he steered it, along with its Canadian affiliate, into a cartel with France's two major nickel producers. In 1934, he brought the biggest German nickel producer, I.G. Farben, into the cartel. This gave Nazi Germany access to the cartel's resources. without Dulles, according to a study of Sullivan and Cromwell. Quote, Germany would have lacked any negotiating strength with international nickel, which controlled the world's supply of nickel, a crucial ingredient in stainless steel and armor plate, unquote. I.G. Farben was also one of the world's largest chemical companies. It would produce the Zyklon B gas used at Nazi death camps, and as Foster was bringing it into the nickel cartel, he also helped it establish a global chemical cartel. He was a board member and legal counsel for another chemical producer, the Solvay conglomerate, based in Belgium. During the 1930s, he guided Solvay, I.G. Farben, the American firm Allied Chemical and Dye, and several other companies into a chemical cartel just as potent as the one he had organized for nickel producers. In mid-1931, a consortium of American banks eager to safeguard their investments in Germany persuaded the German government to accept a loan of nearly $500 million to prevent default. Foster was their agent. His ties to the German government tightened after Hitler took power at the beginning of 1933 and appointed Foster's old friend Hjalmar Schacht as Minister of Economics. Hjalmar Schacht, of course, also an old friend of Clay Shaw's as well. Continuing. Alan Dulles had introduced the two men, Foster Dulles and Hjalmar Schacht, a decade earlier when he was a diplomat in Berlin and Foster passed through regularly on Sullivan and Cromwell business. They were immediately drawn to each other. Schacht spoke fluent English and understood the United States well. Like Dulles, he projected an air of brisk authority. He was tall, gaunt, and always erect with close-cropped hair and high, tight collars. Both men had considered entering the clergy before turning their powerful minds toward more remunerative pursuits. Each admired the culture that had produced the other. Both, and this is important, both believed that a resurgent Germany would stand against Bolshevism, mobilizing American capital to finance its rise was their common interest. Pivotally important, you can read these last two sentences again. Both, meaning John Foster Dulles and Hjalmar Horace Greeley Schacht, both believed that a resurgent Germany would stand against Bolshevism. Mobilizing American capital to finance its rise was their common interest. Working with Schacht, Foster helped the National Socialist State find rich sources of financing in the U.S. for its public agencies, banks, and industries. The two men, Dulles and Schacht, shaped complex restructurings of German loan obligations at several debt conferences, unquote, in Berlin, conferences that were officially among bankers but were in fact closely guided by the German and American governments, and came up with the new formulas that made it easier for the Germans to borrow money from American banks. Sullivan and Cromwell floated the first American bonds issued by the giant German steelmaker and arms manufacturer Krupp AG, extended IG Farben's global reach, and fought successfully to block Canada's effort to restrict the export of steel to German arms makers. We're going to come back to that probably in our next program. We're going to talk about that. We're also going to talk about the Harriman interests as well. Sullivan and Cromwell floated the first American bonds issued by the German steelmaker and arms manufacturer Krupp AG, extended IG Farben's global reach, and fought successfully to block Canada's effort to restrict the export of steel to German arms makers. According to one history, the firm, quote, represented several provincial governments, some large industrial combines, a number of big American companies with interests in the Reich, and some rich individuals, unquote. By another account, it, quote, thrived on its cartels and collusion with the new Nazi regime, unquote. The columnist Drew Pearson gleefully listed the German clients of Sullivan and Cromwell, who had contributed money to the Nazis, and described Foster as chief agent for, quote, the banking circles that rescued Adolf Hitler from the financial depths and set up his Nazi party as a going concern, unquote. Although the relationship between Foster and Schacht began well and thrived for years, it ended badly. I'd say that's Stephen Kinzer's opinion. I think it probably ended quite well, albeit behind the scenes. Continuing. Schacht contributed decisively to German rearmament and publicly urged Jews to, quote, realize that their influence in Germany has disappeared for all time, unquote. Although he later broke with Hitler and left the government, he would be tried at Nuremberg for, quote, crimes against peace, unquote. He was acquitted, but the chief American prosecutor, Robert Jackson, called him, quote, the facade of starch responsibility, who in the early days provided the window dressing, the bait for the hesitant, unquote. He baited no one more successfully than Foster. And again, that's Hjalmar Schacht, a friend of Clay Shaw's. Continuing. During the mid-1930s, through a series of currency maneuvers, discounted buybacks, and other forms of financial warfare, Germany effectively defaulted on its debts to American investors. Foster represented the investors in unsuccessful appeals to Germany, many of them addressed to his old friend, Schacht. Clients who had followed Sullivan and Cromwell's advice to buy German bonds lost fortunes. That advice, according to one study, quote, cost Americans $1 billion because Schacht seduced Dulles into supporting Germany for far too long, unquote. Foster had clear financial reasons to collaborate with the Nazi regime, and his ideological reason, Hitler was fiercely anti-Bolshevik, was equally compelling. In later years, scholars would ask about his actions in the world. Did he do it out of a desire to protect economic privilege or out of anti-communist fervor? The best answer may be that to him, there was no difference. In his mind, defending multinational business and fighting Bolshevism were the same thing. Since 1933, all letters written from the German offices of Sullivan and Cromwell had ended, as required by German regulations, with the salutation, Heil Hitler. That did not disturb Foster. He churned out magazine and newspaper articles asserting that the, quote, dynamic, unquote, countries of the world, Germany, Italy, and Japan, quote, feel within themselves potentialities which are suppressed, unquote, and that Hitler's semi-secret rearmament project simply showed that, quote, Germany, by unilateral action, has now taken back her freedom of action. So again, not only the role of nickel interests in John Foster's machinations vis-a-vis I.G. Farben, as he cobbled that together, but also the relationship between Hjalmar Schacht, Sullivan and Cromwell, John Foster Dulles, and both the international nickel interests and Hjalmar Schacht linked to Clay Shaw. More about I.G. Farben, more about Sullivan and Cromwell, more about both Dulles's, and about the Schroeders in the following. This is from the landmark text, The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, the CIA, and the Rise of America's Secret Government by David Talbot. This was published in copyright 2015, published by Harper's in hardcover.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
Lois, that's Alan Lois. Lois and Thomas McKittrick of the Bank of International Settlements continued to work closely together for the rest of the war. In the final months of the conflict, the two men collaborated against a Roosevelt operation called Project Safe Haven that sought to track down and confiscate Nazi assets that were stashed in neutral countries. I should add before continuing here, Project Safe Haven was the abortive Allied and American operation to interdict the Nazi flight capital program, which was absolutely successful and which coalesced again as the remarkable and deadly Bormann organization. One more time. Douglas and Thomas McKittrick of the Bank of International Settlements continued to work closely together for the rest of the war. In the final months of the conflict, the two men collaborated against a Roosevelt operation called Project Safe Haven that sought to track down and confiscate Nazi assets that were stashed in neutral countries. Administration officials feared that, by hiding their ill-gotten wealth, members of the German elite planned to bide their time after the war and would then try to regain power. Morgenthau's Treasury Department team, which spearheaded Project Safe Haven, reached out to the OSS and the Bank for International Settlements for assistance, but Douglas and McKittrick were more inclined to protect their clients' interests. Moreover, like many in the upper echelons of U.S. finance and national security, Douglas believed that a good number of these powerful German figures should be returned to power to ensure that Germany would be a strong bulwark against the Soviet Union. And during the Cold War, he would be more intent on using Nazi loot to finance covert anti-Soviet operations than on returning it to the families of Hitler's victims. One has to wonder about that $50 million account in the Schroeder Bank and to what extent that may have been provided to him by elements in the Bormann network, or perhaps even the residua of the summer Canto S. Continuing. Douglas realized that none of his arguments against Project Safe Haven would be well received by Morgenthau, so he resorted to time-honored methods of bureaucratic stalling and sabotage to help sink the operation, explaining in a December 1944 memo to his OSS superiors that his Bern, Switzerland office lacked, quote, adequate personnel to do an effective job in this field and meet other demands, unquote. Skipping down. While Alan Dulles was using his OSS post in Switzerland to protect the interests of Sullivan and Cromwell's German clients, his brother was doing the same in New York. By playing an intricate corporate shell game, Foster was able to hide the U.S. assets of major German cartels like IG Farben and Merck KGaA, the chemical and pharmaceutical giant, and protect these subsidiaries from being confiscated by the federal government as alien property. Some of Foster's legal origami allowed the Nazi regime to create bottlenecks in the production of essential war materials, such as diesel fuel injection motors that the U.S. military needed for trucks, submarines, and airplanes. By the end of the war, many of Foster's clients were under investigation by the Justice Department's Antitrust Division, and Foster himself was under scrutiny for collaboration with the enemy. The Foster's brother was guarding his back. From his frontline position in Europe, Alan was well-placed to destroy incriminating evidence and block any investigations that threatened the two brothers and their law firm. Quote, shredding of captured Nazi records was the favorite tactic of Dulles and his associates, who stayed behind to help run the occupation of post-war Germany, unquote, observed Nazi hunter John Loftus, who pored through numerous war documents related to the Dulles brothers when he served as a U.S. prosecutor in the Justice Department under President Jimmy Carter. If their powerful enemy in the White House had survived the war, the Dulles brothers would likely have faced serious criminal charges for their wartime activities. Supreme Court Justice Arthur Goldberg, who as a young man served with Allen in the OSS, later declared that both Dulleses were guilty of treason. And as noted in one of the last interviews with Jim DiGenio, Arthur Goldberg at one point was being considered for as being the chief counsel for the House Select Committee on Assassinations. He, before doing that, wanted to know if the CIA would cooperate with the investigation. He called up then CIA Director Admiral Stansfield Turner and got a prolonged silence. And Turner then told him when Goldberg inquired if he was still on the line, that is your answer, meaning the silence, meaning no, the CIA would not collaborate. Something to remember, and we're going to come back to this in our next program. One of the people who collaborated very closely with Allen Dulles, and also, as we will see, the Bush family, George Herbert Walker and Prescott Bush, was the German industrialist Fritz Thyssen, and also Thyssen's brother, Baron Heinrich Thyssen-Bornemisza, who married into the Hungarian aristocracy and remained officially neutral. From Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, copyright 1981, available for download for free on the SpitfireList.com website. Also, Bormann felt that Fritz Thyssen was his ace in the hole if he ever needed a pipeline to Allen W. Dulles. In two interviews with Gerard Williams, we took a look at the book Grey Wolf, The Flight of Adolf Hitler, and the working hypothesis by both Gerard Williams and his co-author that, in fact, Hitler's escape from Europe, which in and of itself is a matter of record, exactly where he wound up, has been masked by the proverbial bodyguard of lies, but he certainly escaped. The notion that Hitler died in the ruins of Berlin was basically a concoction, as we looked at in one of our interviews with Peter Lavenda, then MI6 officer, British Overseas Intelligence Officer Hugh Trevor Roper, later Sir Hugh Trevor Roper, was the guiding light for a British psychological warfare operation called Operation Nursery. A very interesting title. The idea was to lay the little children to sleep, to lull them into, as it turned out, a false sense of security that the Nazi boogeyman had been laid to rest. Operation Nursery, again, the code name for the British intelligence operation, very much like the generation of the Warren Report, as I noted, the codename for the British PSYOP operation, that was the codename for the British PSYOP, to generate the official lie that Adolf Hitler died in the ruins of Berlin at the end of World War II. Exactly where he went is a matter of some confusion. Certainly Latin America, apparently for a time, then perhaps Indonesia, but certainly Hitler's death, alleged death, in the ruins of Berlin is simply a myth, and one that basically was concocted by British intelligence as elements of British intelligence were collaborating with the Dulleses and others to realize the Christian West concept. Again, I have two interviews of a link with Gerard Williams about his book, Grey Wolf, The Escape of Adolf Hitler. Something that we have noted in the past, and again we're going to come to Allen Dulles, and not only his role as speechwriter, really in effect, campaign manager for the campaign of Thomas Dewey in 1948 when he was challenging Harry Truman, but also his role in creating something called the Crusade for Freedom. The Crusade for Freedom was a binary covert operation, completely illegal in that some of it was in the U.S. itself. This, on the one hand, generated funds for what author John Loftus has termed the Nazi Freedom Fighter Program, the use of Axis combatants as guerrillas to fight the Soviet Union, primarily in Eastern Europe and parts of the former Soviet Union itself, such as Ukraine with the OUND and the Baltic states. At the same time, the Crusade for Freedom helped to elevate many of these Axis collaborators from Eastern Europe into positions of political leadership in some of the important Eastern European ethnic voting blocs in the Rust Belt, the former industrial Midwest and Northeast, so that they could counteract traditional democratic influence with these voting blocs. Very quickly, from The Secret War Against the Jews by John Loftus and Mark Ahrens. Frustration over Truman's 1948 election victory over Dewey, which they blamed on the Jewish vote, impelled Dulles and his protege Richard Nixon to work toward the realization of the fascist freedom fighter presence in the Republican Party's ethnic outreach organization. As a young congressman, Nixon had been Alan Dulles' confidant. They both blamed Governor Dewey's razor-thin loss to Truman in the 1948 presidential election to the Jewish vote. When he became Eisenhower's vice president in 1952, Nixon was determined to build his own ethnic base. Nixon's secret political war of Nazis against Jews in American politics was never investigated at the time. The foreign language-speaking Croatians and other fascist emigre groups had a ready-made network for contacting and mobilizing the Eastern European ethnic bloc. There is a very high correlation between CIA domestic subsidies to fascist freedom fighters and during the 1950s and the leadership of the Republican Party's ethnic campaign groups. The motive for the under-the-table financing was clear. Nixon used Nazis to offset the Jewish vote for the Democrats. In 1952, Nixon had formed an ethnic division within the Republican National Committee, displaced fascists hoping to be returned to power by an Eisenhower-Nixon liberation policy signed on with the committee. In 1953, when Republicans were in office, the immigration laws were changed to admit Nazis, even members of the SS. They flooded into the country. Nixon himself oversaw the new immigration program as vice president. He even received Eastern European fascists in the White House. And we will continue with the Crusade for Freedom, Alan Dulles, and link this to the Galen Organization and more in our next program. However, this concludes For the Record program number 1059, The Christian West, Part 2, Contextual Foundation of the Jim DiEugenio Interviews. This is being recorded on March 5th of the year 2019. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.